I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to discuss the ways the mind approaches learning. We're going to talk about educational neuroscience. We're going to explore the intersection between biological processes and education. My guests today will be three people well-versed in the area. Dr. Lori Desitels of Marion University, Washington Township School Superintendent Dr. Nikki Woodson, and Learning Specialist Terry Small. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about educational neuroscience. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Dr. Lori Desitels from Marion University. Lori, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Dr. Nikki Woodson, who is with Washington is the superintendent of Washington Township Schools. Welcome to the program,
Thank Nikki. You. My pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. And joining us by phone is Terry Small, who is a learning specialist. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be part of this.
It's good to have you all here. Well, I think we probably ought to start because, educational neuroscience is one of those multisyllabic phrases that is likely to confuse people. Why don't we start with just a short, simple definition of what we're talking about here, Dr. Lori Desitels.
Okay.
We're going to do without the doctors. We're all friends
good.
Here. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So educational neuroscience is not an extra program. It is a strategy. It's a principle. It's a way of being and teaching and learning for both teacher and student. So when we talk about this, we are really looking at how to teach to every student's unique brain. And when I talk about the unique brain, we're looking at how every moment-to-moment experience structurally and functionally changes that brain. And this is the best news for parents and for educators.
Break that down a little bit further for
okay.
me. In terms of when we talk about how we approach, in what ways do we change the educational experience?
So what we know is that the brain learns in specific ways. There are natural ways that the brain ingests and interprets and then responds to information, to stimuli from the environment. So when we take content as teachers that we're teaching, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples, when we weave that content into patterns, when we take the content and we put it into stories, when we personalize the information, we bring the information to life. We give it vibrancy, and it becomes very relevant and meaningful to the child. And therefore, with emotion, and this is a huge part of educational neuroscience, when we put emotion into the content and personalize it, we have engagement and attention. And engagement and attention are what drive learning and memory, and then transferring that knowledge into everyday life.
So is it a more customized approach to education, more individualized approach?
I think it's both. It's individualized, it's small group, it's whole class. And actually, this is what I was kind of tired of the research and thought, I have to do this myself. So I'm actually in Crooked Creek Elementary School sitting side by side with the fifth grade teachers. And to answer your question, we are integrating this into the standards, you know, into what the students are having to learn. And so it's strategies, it's an approach. It's when you say customized, it is really just an integration of taking how the brain learns naturally.
Nikki Woodson, Crooked Creek, obviously,
yes.
is a Washington Township
it
school.
Is.
Is this a pilot or an a different sort of approach that you're trying, experimenting with in Washington Township, and what have you seen so far?
Well, I think you can ask any educator, especially in our urban public schools here in Marion County, are there classrooms where there's a variety of different learners with different needs? And 100% of the teachers would say yes. So the needs haven't emerged. We have known this as educators for a long time. We've done professional development to help teachers with strategies to differentiate learning for the students. We buy materials that are differentiated for the students. The partnership we have here that just began this year that is very exciting is a hands-on approach to modeling for teachers exactly what it is based on brain research that are strategies that can be easily implemented. You know, when I heard her describe the definition for educational neuroscience, immediately I thought the people who are experts at this are advertisers. They capture the heart. They engage the listener or reader. And this is what we're trying to do for the student. We're trying to capture them emotionally and engage them with the teaching and learning process.
Terry Small, is in terms of this, is it really just about holding the student's attention, or is there something else that is going on there?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, I've heard so many good things from Lori and Nikki just now. And Nikki, I just love the connection you make with advertising. I spend a lot of time actually working with marketers. Marketers are probably the most avid consumers of brain research on the planet. When you think about what marketers have to do, they've got to interrupt a busy brain, your busy brain, in the middle of a day and attach an unwanted message about whatever product they're trying to sell onto your brain in such a way that it might stick. And you might actually select that product the next time you go into the supermarket. So I think actually teachers can learn a lot from that field. Marketers can learn a lot from teachers. It really comes back to something, Lori, you said, it's really a way of being. I mean, what I tell teachers is you can have the best content on the planet, and I'm sure you do, the best lesson plans, things well thought out and structured. But if that content, if your excellent content is not connected to a learner in the right brain state with a good brain-based strategy, then the Teflon factor will be very, very high. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you mean by the
Teflon factor? You can't remember what you don't pay attention to. And so what I think I'm hearing from Nikki and Lori is there's a real attempt in the schools to increase the attention density on the part of the kids in terms of math and social studies and science and things that perhaps they may not always have a natural interest in.
Absolutely.
And ultimately you end up with engagement.
We are talking about educational neuroscience here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, in terms of, it sounds like a lot of this is about forcing the students to engage, and it's a break with the sort of eat your vegetables approach to education. You got to study this stuff because it's good for you, and not necessarily because you really want to
right.
eat it.
And not forcing. You know, yeah. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't force him to drink. But what we can do as educators is we can salt their oats to make them want to drink. And I think that's our job as educators. We have to do school differently. All of us listening, most of us listening, attended
probably
school.
I ought to step in and emphasize that you're not really salting their oats.
No. Thank you for that point of clarification. But we have to do school differently. We are teaching a different learner today. The way we went to school, the way we learned in school, it has to be different today. It's a different world.
Well, and I guess to take this down to a level, I think, where people can engage and understand it, let's assume, say, I am the parent of a fifth grade girl who loves to read, and a second grade boy who loves sports and physical activity, which, you know, in my case is not that far a stretch from the truth anyhow. You know, how would this be different? How would this change their kind of educational experience, Lori?
All right. So when you talk about the 7 or 8 year old second grade boy who loves sports, one of the things that when we look at educational neuroscience, we build to a child's strengths. We look at their passions and their interests. So we take what is relevant and meaningful, which would be sports to that young boy, and we would build that into the curriculum. And we would tap into, again, those aspects of learning that that student is passionate about, that he's interested in. And that doesn't mean that we change the curriculum or, you know, we're still teaching to the standards. We still are, you know, following curriculum, but we take what that child knows well. When we can tap into a child or a student's expertise, this is where the rubber meets the road. Because when they begin to feel capable and successful in their learning, then we see shifts. And this is what neuroplasticity is about, which is a huge
word. Probably ought to explain what neuroplasticity is.
So yeah. That is exactly when we take an experience and we integrate this child or student's expertise, even an adult's. Mm-hmm. When we make these neural connections, we get that aha moment. We know, we make that connection with new information, connecting it with something we are already good at, and mm-hmm. we know that's neuroplasticity. And really, that is learning. When we learn something, we make connections. We make emotional connections. We make cognitive connections. And we make social connections.
We are talking about educational neuroscience here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I am a treatment counselor and a family coach at Volunteers of America in Indianapolis, and we specialize in working with men and women who are incarcerated, and something that we do that's a little unique is that we go and we work with the children and the caretakers of the women and men that are incarcerated, and we, you know, go out into the community and do what we can to help and support those families. What I have seen be a very, very common trend is many kids that are very bright, very smart, have a lot of life, a lot of personality, that are struggling in the classroom, many times due to the stress of being separated from their parents or some traumas that have happened to them. And I was just wondering if perhaps you could speak to how, what kind of special attention or suggestions, or how this would just apply to kids that are in very high stress environments, specifically those who have maybe incarcerated parents.
Absolutely.
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Rachel.
In Washington Township, I have 11,000 students. So you can imagine the wide range of experiences that these 11,000 students bring to our classrooms every day. We have to have a myriad of supports in place for these students and their families for a variety of reasons. One of those is stress on children. Some of these kids have experienced things that I haven't even as an adult, but yet they're coming to school every day, and stress can interfere with learning, like she said. So we do have a myriad of supports put in place. We can't ignore the fact that what's happening to students outside and ask them to shed that away when they come into the classroom. We do have to support them. We have to deal with it. We have to put the proper things
in
place.
How do you deal with it? I mean, what would be the approach in that situation? How would you engage with that student and work differently?
Okay, so very concrete, one-on-one. When a child comes in stressed and is experiencing this, the one aspect in their life that they have control and power over is their brain. And we emphasize that the positive aspects of that. You have complete control and you are in charge of your thinking and your feeling. And we start with that aspect. That is one thing. No one can tell you how to feel, how to think. You are in charge. So now where do we go from there? And that's the first step.
A real concrete example that we are seeing at Crooked Creek in Washington Township that you have modeled for us, Lori, is the kind of the break right before a test. Why don't you describe that process for students that we're modeling?
Okay. It's called a focused attention practice, and this is an educational neuroscience strategy that is just the students and the teachers are using it incredibly. So we get very quiet. We focus on an image. We focus on a sound. We focus on a thought. And for about 90 seconds from the beginning to the end, We hone in on whatever the direction is that day. We get very, very quiet. We breathe very deeply because we know what stress does, and we can talk about that later in the show to the body. Mm-hmm. And we're doing this 2 to 3 times a day, and we take that attention and move it right into the lesson.
We are talking about educational neuroscience here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Lori Desitels, Marion University, Nikki Woodson, who's superintendent of Washington Township Schools, and Terry Small, a learning specialist. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about educational neuroscience. My guests are Dr. Lori Desitels of Marion University, Dr. Nikki Woodson, who is the Washington Township School Superintendent, and Terry Small, who is a learning specialist. Terry, we were talking about some different strategies, and probably ought to talk now about where the research is on this. What is there evidence out there? Have there been studies showing that this works? What do the numbers show?
You often hear it referred to as the neuro revolution. And so one of the things that I do, John, is I sort of consider myself somebody who works in the area of applied neuroscience. So I really look at trying to find concrete things that neuroscientists, basically, they'll develop a principle. For example, the brain has a bias for questions. So when you hear a question, immediately, if you're walking down the street and you're sort of unfocused, chasing light, fuzzy thoughts, and somebody approaches you and asks you a question, immediately your brain will focus. And it's not your imagination. You actually will release a chemical in your brain, which increases attention density. So neuroscientists will sort of discover that and come up with that as a principle. And so what I try and do is look at, okay, so what does that mean now for a parent? What does that mean for a teacher? What does that mean for a leader? What does that mean for a 13-year-old studying her French at 6 o'clock at night at the kitchen table? And so when you sort of look at strategies that are built around these principles and then you look at the results, they are phenomenal. I mean, we know, for example, something as simple as standing up to study your French vocabulary, for example, will improve your retention by 10%. Simply taking your finger and running it across the material as you read it will improve retention by 25%.
Why is that? I mean, do we know why that is?
Actually, if you think of, to the first point, when you stand up, you get 10% more blood flow to the brain, so it's incredibly important as a learner. I just spoke to 400 parents and students at a high school in Vancouver last night, and I asked them, I said, how many of you have noticed that it's easier to learn when you're awake? And, of course, people laugh. But the reality of it is, there are lots of things you can do to increase your level of alertness. And to go back to Lori's point, increase your attention density and your engagement. So I'm not really answering your question. So to the point of standing up, you get 10% more blood flow to the brain. That wakes your brain up, which makes you more effective. I read a study recently that students were 30% faster solving math problems on their feet as opposed to sitting down. So to the second point about running your finger across the page, mm-hmm. One of the greatest discoveries about the brain in the last 400 years, I mean, if you think, thinking is a process of electrical chemical reaction. It takes place physically across a rich tapestry of connections in your brain, and it can be observed. And what has been discovered is that 85% of the neural messaging in your brain originates in a clump of structures that sits on the brainstem that collectively are called the limbic system. Only 15% come back from the cortical areas. The cortical areas are, the executive function, logic. The limbic system is the emotional part of the brain. So practically speaking, from a teacher's point of view, from a student's point of view, that makes the number one job of the brain to keep you alive. Brains are beautifully designed to thrive in an outdoor, ever-changing, dangerous environment. It sounds a lot like a classroom to me. So, you know, to full credit to Nikki and Lori, there's so much of what is being discovered in neuroscience that can kind of honor the way brains actually naturally engage with the environment. So by simply running your finger across the page, you're adding movement to the process, and your brain has an attentional bias for movement. Eat or be eaten. If you're watching television and you see something scurry under the cabinet in the corner of the room, you're going to look. Why? Because it could be something to eat. It could be something coming to eat you. So these are just some of the simple things that any student can do. And when the student, my experience has been, when the students do these things, they go, wow, it worked. What's next?
We are talking about educational neuroscience here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, Lori, even you know, as Terry has just said here, the brain's got a bias towards questions, which, you know, in terms of like a teaching methodology, would argue, you know, maybe Socratic method might be a little more effective than at the most basic level than a standard lecture. Are there other ways it's going to transform the way we I hate to use the term deliver education, but that we teach, that we approach the process of teaching people?
Yes, and I want to back that up with the research, because there is, since the 80s and 90s, there's just a plethora of research. And we tend to, you know, people that are a little tentative look at the neuromyths. And we're not talking about neuromyths, just as Terry talked about today. Jeb Schneck, Dr. Martin Seligman, Dr. David or Richie Davison, Dr. Kurt Fisher out of Harvard, Tufts program, social emotional learning. I mean, the research is burgeoning right now. So when, to answer your question, when we talk about looking at the ways that we teach and we learn, what these principles are sharing with us is that when we create, when we design, when we innovate, when we imagine, and those are those higher thought processes that ask us to problem solve and really rest with the question. It is okay to rest with the question. Those are those thought processes that really help us to think outside of the box. And as to Terry's point, when we ask a question, the brain processes the question long after it's been asked. That is a very...
By long after, what do you mean by long?
Well, I mean, it depends...
3 hours?
Well, yeah. It depending on the individual, but we know that that question sits, you know, sits there, and we can look at eye movements, too, to determine, you know, how that question is being processed. So the point here is that when we ask a question, the brain immediately goes into that survival mode where it's wondering what's next. And that's a brain state of anticipation and curiosity. And those are about the two best brain states as teachers that we can create in our classroom. I did that this morning. It's asking.
I observed that this morning of you.
It's asking a question. I love to use prediction. What do you think is inside this scroll when we're teaching decimals? It may, and they're looking at me like, Dr. Lori, what does this have to do with decimals? But again, they begin to think outside of the box, and every answer we really affirm their participation and not the answers. So it becomes very safe to answer questions and to think and take some time and be reflective.
Nikki, I'm going to take this. How is it going to change the way that we have to prepare teachers?
Absolutely. John, I get asked by parents a lot, why do we have to do school differently? Why does my child's classroom look differently than when I was in elementary or middle school or high school?
All in a row.
I learned just fine. Forward. Why can't my child learn the same way? Lori just said it. We have current best practice research. And if your dentist filled your cavity the way they filled cavity 30, 40 years ago, that would be considered malpractice.
Right.
And it's the same thing in the field of education. We have to adapt to the best practices based on research. These strategies are a part of that. So certainly our pre-service teachers are learning these strategies. Our teachers who are currently in the profession.
What do you mean by pre-service teachers?
Thank you. Pre-service teachers are teachers who are working on their certification or license to become a teacher. And so they're with a university or a college doing their coursework and their classroom experiences to obtain that license. And there is an aspect of learning on the job. You know, I was speaking to Lori before we began this program today saying we can't sit teachers down for a half day workshop and say, do XYZ in the classroom. This is a hands-on modeling based partnership, and that's the power of it to build capacity with our teachers in Washington Township.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about educational neuroscience, really about the way the mind mm-hmm. learns, mm-hmm. The entry points for learning. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, build me then. Lori, I'm going to start with you, and then Terry, after Lori. Mm-hmm. Build me... the ideal school making use of this new research, because it's since we're talking 80s mm-hmm. or 90s, mm-hmm. at least in the right. lifespan of American education, that's still a relatively recent development mm-hmm. And a new wave. What would the ideal school look like if we were going to make the best use of what we know now?
Well, a couple of ideals come into mind, and one of the very first thoughts that I have is culture, building a school culture, which is about relationships, which is about making those emotional and those social connections. Because as we've already discussed today, when we build culture, when there is a community of learners and teachers that feel safe and that feel comfortable to take a chance, to take a risk, then we have set the stage for creative, innovative, imaginative learning. So that's the first aspect. The other aspect that comes to mind, and in special education, we develop individualized education plans for children that have needs, social, emotional, academic. My dream before I pass away is to see every student with an individualized educational plan. I would absolutely, I think that this is imperative because, as we've said, each brain learns, it ingests, it retrieves, and it manipulates information in such different ways.
Terry, what would the ideal school look like from your perspective?
Well, my small contribution to an ideal school would be, my whole teaching pedagogy comes down to state strategy content. So if we think of those 3 points of an equilateral triangle, would be teachers who are aware and manage that triangle. I think it really comes back to something Lori said earlier. It's really a way of being. We can find excellent content. We can build excellent buildings. At the end of the day, though, if the kids aren't in the right brain state, then the Teflon factor will be very, very high. So an ideal school would be one where there's a conversation about the brain. Kids love to know about their brains. It really will shape their entire time in schools. So this conversation would extend to parents. It would extend to grandparents. You'd hear the teachers talking about it. It would be, I mean, your brain is involved in everything you do. Everything that happens reshapes your brain. I mean, Lori was absolutely right. The brain you have yesterday does not exist today. The brain you have today will not exist tomorrow. Your brain literally reshapes itself, rewires itself in real time, dynamically based on your experience. So an ideal school would be one, as Lori said, where you have a collective brain state of anticipation and students wanting to learn. And it starts really with knowing why they go to school in the first place. Most kids don't know why they go to school. I asked this question of the group I had last night, and if students don't really know why they're in school, then frankly, why would they necessarily put their best foot forward every day? So for me, when I think of a school, John, I think of the collection of people. I think of the collection of brains. I think of essentially, you know, what Lori first mentioned, a collective brain state that produces a culture where people want to learn.
Well, are we talking, in practical terms, and I hate to kind of reduce it to this level, but to smaller class sizes so that you can engage at, you know, that's an area obviously that has been somewhat debated over time. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me, since we've got to figure out the learning patterns for this to work for each student, you can't have 40 or 50 students to a class.
John, let me just add this to what I said, and also to what you just said. Students who are in the right brain state will run through a brick wall to get to class on time. Students who are in the right brain state will run through a brick wall to get their math homework done. An athlete in the right brain state will climb halfway up the gymnasium wall to dig a volleyball back for his or her team. So I think that this is where the big payoff is. And I'm from Canada, of course, and we call our governing body the Ministry of Education. You hardly ever hear the Ministry of Education talk about brain state. There's a lot of talk about curriculum. There's a lot of talk about content, as there should be. Students need to learn stuff. However, the big, big payoff is in shifting brain state, and that's where neuroscience comes in. And I've got to say this again, Nikki, when you mentioned, you know, that we could learn a lot from marketers and advertisers, it was all I could do to restrain myself from clapping in my office. I mean, at the end of the day, you want your students to get to class on time. How are you going to sell them on that?
Mm-hmm. Well,
you
I guess
like students to get their homework done reasonably well and on time. How are you going to sell them on that? Do you want your students to treat each other with dignity and respect within your buildings? How are you going to sell them on that?
Yeah, and I guess we're...
can add value to somebody's life. Well, there's a lot of kids that don't believe that. How are you going to sell them on that?
I guess where I am, though, and the question I've got here is, in Nikki's case, she's got 11,000 students.
Yes.
That
650 teachers.
That she has to serve. To some degree, to deal with those 11,000, we have to be able to figure out a way to institutionalize this, to make
absolutely
to set up a structure so that you can meet them at that point. How do we do that?
The careful balance there, as an administrator, as the instructional leader of a large organization such as Washington Township, is the balance. You can't say every student needs a class size of X. Some may need a smaller class size, and some may be perfectly fine with a class size of 25. In Washington Township, we see the needs of each individual child, differentiating the learning as we've been talking about, and provide small group support for some students, smaller entry to high school for some students, regular entry. We provide transitional programs for students. We offer a myriad of supports because one size is not going to fit all for education.
Well, and I would think the other part of all of this, Lori, would be that you need to have fairly regular testing on this, because if we're talking about the brain changing from day to day, and to some degree I'm even hearing from moment to moment,
right,
with each experience altering, you know, the makeup, you've got to be able to track that at some level and make adjustments in the educational plan.
Absolutely. And that's why this educational neuroscience, these principles are such a good fit right now for this testing phenomenal time that we're in. You know, we have teachers tracking.
Are we testing in the right ways, though?
Well, and that could be a whole nother show.
I know.
All by itself.
Give me a short answer, but I guess to some degree,
well,
is the standardized test then a model for what we should be doing?
Well, I don't think so. But the reality is, here's where we are. So we're testing to two intelligences. We're testing to math and logistics, and we're testing to language. And we have students that are experts and that have just incredible intelligence and geniuses in so many other areas, music and interpersonal skills. So we're not teaching to those. But here is where the rubber meets the road with this, is that we can, again, when we make this content relevant and meaningful and ask, why would you ever need to know a persuasive paragraph? We bring it to the real world, real time, because someday you're going to need to write, have an interview. You're going to need to write a resume. So we build in all of these outside factors.
We are talking about educational neuroscience here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are Dr. Lori Desitels, Marion University, Dr. Nikki Woodson, who is the superintendent of Washington Township Schools, Terry Smalls, a learning specialist. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about educational neuroscience. My guests are Dr. Lori Desitels of Marion University, Dr. Nikki Woodson, who is the Washington Township School Superintendent, and Terry Small, who is a learning specialist, joining us by phone. Brandon, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I'm one of those pre-service teachers they were talking about earlier. I'm a little bit older. I left my career to go back into teaching. But you mentioned earlier about safe environments for students, emotionally safe, where they can ask questions. And this has been one of my, philosophies, I guess, in coming into teaching about offering safe environments for, like, high school kids. And I wrote a paper a couple semesters ago about this, creating safe environments for high school students, and all the research was just on elementary school. And I wondered, is there any research out there on a high school level for older students about ways to create safe environments for them so they can interact, more comfortable interacting in a classroom?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Brandon. We'll try to get an answer for you. Lori?
So the first place I would point you to is Dr. Jeb Schneck, and he writes it just implicitly about the adolescent brain.
Probably ought to spell Schneck.
Yeah, so let's see. It's S-C-H-N-E-K, Jeb, J-E-B. And his work is amazing. His research is extensive, and he talks about this culture and about building these very brain-compatible environments, not only for the student, Brandon, but also for teachers, because we are talking about teachers today, too, and the strategies just as much apply to them.
We were talking before we went to the break also about the notion of testing, and that walks into that area of really what education should be about. And I think we've kind of danced around this question about whether it's simply the delivery of a certain set of skills, or it is sort of the way that helping to develop the mind as it engages with the larger world. The political debate, obviously, a lot of the focus now is on standardized testing, is on making sure that we've got these measurable demonstrations of skills being acquired. Is that the proper focus for education, Nikki?
In Washington Township, we view the required standardized test that we have to give at various grades the floor for our students, and what we're teaching is the ceiling. So yes, that's the bare minimum we want our students to know. And yes, we need to know if our students do know that. But the analogy I give to parents when I talk to them about assessments is I can't step on a scale January 1st of each year and determine my entire year's health plan based on that one day I step on a scale. That would be ridiculous. And we can't do that with a standardized test either. You know, a third grader takes the state standardized test once a year. We cannot determine that child's progress throughout the year based on that one test that we give. That's why we have to give multiple assessments. As the proud superintendent in Washington Township, I am proud to say that we address the whole child, as Lori was talking about earlier. We don't just rely on the things that the standardized test measure as a mark for our success of our students. Through the International Baccalaureate Program, we are doing kindergarten through 12th grade, one of few school districts nationwide to do this for every child. In every school, we address the whole child.
What would be a better system of testing?
I think that we are a society of absolutes, so I look at balance to answer your question. And one of the ways that when I'm working with my graduate students who are first and second year teachers and undergraduate students, preparing them, is we look at a standard that we have to teach. And with that standard, we create a multiple choice question that looks standardized. The students will have to know how to answer that standardized question. But right next to that test question, we design and create an assessment that is engaging, that is project-based, and that is very interesting and relevant to that standard. So it's a variety.
We are talking about educational neuroscience here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I find your program really interesting today.
Thank you.
My question was related to the neuroscience approach in education and how long it's been used at Washington Township and other places to be able to better determine how well and effective it's been in regards to the ISTEP tests.
Sure, great question.
Thanks very much for the call, Lee.
In Washington Township, we have been looking at research-based ways to educate our children at the various level in age-appropriate ways for years. I mean, ever since the research became apparent, we've been looking at the best way to do this. The newness is the partnership we have with Lori, who is currently in our classrooms modeling some research-based techniques with our teachers hand-in-hand with live students. It's not her standing up in front of teachers saying, go back to your classrooms and doing this. She's saying, let's do this together in your classroom. So we're doing a new delivery of professional development through the partnership. And certainly as research is evolving daily, we stay abreast of the current research.
But have we, to get to Lee's question, have we seen an impact in the ISTEP test scores? I mean, is there a carryover in terms of how the students are performing on the ISTEPs?
Sure. One piece that's so hard to answer about standardized test scores is, was it this program or this thing you did that made the impact? We're doing 500 strategies and research-based practices and programs and initiatives within our schools every single day, every single minute. So to isolate one of those as the sole correlation to increase test scores, which we have this year in Washington Township, is very hard to do. We attribute it to the wraparound supports in differentiating learning for all learners from a variety of methods.
Have you done, like, Lori, and since you're in some way spearheading the pilot here, have you done, like, control groups?
And so we just started. So, you know, I've been at Crooked Creek for 2 months, 8 weeks. So it'll be interesting to see how this evolves. So we're doing pre- and post-assessment. We're looking at engagement and emotion. So we do have a control group in the third, fifth grade classroom. So it'll be interesting to see. But other programs throughout the country, and Dr. Judy Willis, who is going to be coming to Marion at the conference to speak, has worked extensively in the schools, and we'll be discussing that research too. So the research is out there that supports the student growth. And what's interesting is that my first and second year teachers who are in so many IPS, district schools, charter schools, are implementing these strategies in their master's coursework. And so we are looking at the effectiveness and student growth emotionally and academically throughout the semesters.
We are talking about educational neuroscience here on No Limits. I should be grammatical when I say that. Educational neuroscience here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Marinka, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did. Thank you.
All right, good. What's on your mind?
Well, I was calling because I'm very interested in how physical involvement, physical education impacts learning. I have a very young son, and I know quite well that if I don't run him a bit before I try to get him to focus, it's kind of a disaster.
Absolutely.
But speaking from a neuroscience perspective, what sort of research is out there and is being implemented perhaps in the school district? Because as we know, physical education is continuing to be cut to try to meet those standardized testing requirements. And I'm just wondering what kind of research is out there that says physical education really does alter brain state in positive ways and its ability to impact not just immediately in real time, but then going through their day. What does that look like for them from a learning perspective?
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for the call.
Physical education is an important part of the curriculum. All students, all schools have PE or physical education, but all teachers also implement brain-based strategies for movement that impact learning throughout the day that are age appropriate. What you may see in a kindergarten classroom is more frequent breaks, more frequent movement than obviously in a junior level high school course. So we do age appropriate breaks. We break up the learning. For instance, at our middle schools, we have a 90-minute learning block implemented, and that 90-minute learning block is broken up instructionally with strategies based on brain research that we know about that middle level learner.
Terry Small, in terms of that connection between basic physical activity and intellectual achievement, that I'm not even sure, given the context here,
right,
that limiting it that way is, you know, is there a connection? Should we structure particularly our early educational experiences differently so that there is more activity involved in them?
Yes. Actually, to the caller, and I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, there's a fantastic book that you would probably find very interesting. It's called Spark, and the author is John Ratty, R-A-P-E-Y. It's pretty much the standard in terms of how exercise impacts the brain in terms of recent research. Incredibly interesting read. So to your question, John, in terms of structuring a class, a brain typically goes through what are called internal-external cycles. And your brain's sort of like an elevator. It'll go up, it'll get a load, and then once it's got a load, it'll kind of shut back down. And scientists seem to believe that there's a pattern to this. If you take the age of the learner and add 2 to it, so for example, if you are dealing with 13-year-olds, if you have them sitting for more than 15 minutes, you're in trouble. Their brains will start to go into an internal cycle, and it'll do that for a period of time. They'll think about chocolate, lunch, what they're going to do tomorrow, staring out the window, and then maybe somebody will sneeze, the teacher will shift position in the classroom, and they'll click into another external cycle. So I think what brain-based teachers do is, with that in mind, even a simple stand-up for 15 seconds, stretch, do a few cross-lateral movements, which comes out of brain gym, sit back down, I think it will double the productivity of the student. And for an adult, it maxes out at 20, so 18 plus 2, 20. For example, John, when you're working at your desk, if you've got a whole bunch of emails to work through or you're writing on your blog, if you sit for more than 20 minutes, you're in trouble. Simple act of standing up for 15 to 30 seconds, stand up, stretch, have a sip of water, maybe pop a couple of raw walnuts or almonds, incredibly good for shifting brain state. You'll notice a huge increase in your brain's ability to refocus and be productive. That's just a sort of a concrete example to the caller's question about how important, of course, physical education classes are, and then that principle can be carried throughout the day. I often, when I'm teaching, I'll have people stand up for 5 minutes while we're talking and discussing, and they'll plunk back down. The movers in the class are absolutely delighted. In a class of 30, you've got 8 movers, the kids whose brains are wired to move. And so it's also honoring those individual styles as well.
And there are apps that can help with that.
Yeah, they
yes.
are. I actually have one on my computer.
Absolutely, I do too.
yeah, I love mine. It's a clock, and I can project it
correct
on a screen. And I've got 20 different sounds, so when it's time for a brain break, I can program a donkey braying, I can have a Walmart chime, I can have a train horn. Students love it.
Yes, and I encourage students to use that app or that strategy at homework time as well,
so that they stay focused. Tracy, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for taking my
call. Certainly.
My question is, well, first a statement. I'm in my mid-40s, and about 4 years ago, I learned how I learn. So I learn by putting a picture in my mind of what I'm hearing or seeing. And so when I'm trying to recall information, it's not always perfectly accurate because I'm trying to recall the picture. And I think back to I have a college degree, and I think back to when I was younger and learning. I didn't learn. I'd learn to memorize things instead of learning how I learn, which is through pictures. And I'm just wondering if today we're testing kids and helping them learn how they learn, and if we are using the way they learn to teach them. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks very much for the call, Tracy. Well, Lori.
It's just like a huge question, complexity. First, the first part of the question, visual images are fabulous brain-compatible ways to learn. And even though they may not be in exact alignment with the written word, again, it's always both for me. And that's what I believe in. It's this balance. So I think when we can create, for instance, mind maps that take a concept, and it's kind of like a brainstorming map, and use color and images and pictures and shapes, and also then put in the key notes that we need. It's a much better way of preparing the brain to learn deeply and for the long term. And there's lots of research to back that out and or to back that up. And one of the things that we now know is that right behind your eyebrows is the prefrontal cortex. And in this area, this is the seat of attention and decision making. And we call that the executive function. And this is where we take information and we learn this through what we have, the working memory. And that's where we take images, we take sounds, we take movement, as we talked about in the last question. We take notes and we manipulate that information inside the working memory. But here's the key. We have to take that in new information that we're learning and connect it with something that we already know. And that's what we call prior knowledge. So when we make those connections through images, through the written word, the more of the brain that we use, because memory is all over the brain. That's what people, it's not in one location. It's in multiple locations. That's why multisensory teaching is so incredibly important, no matter if we're teaching for a test, because we are engaging the child in numerous ways to learn through the various ways I just talked about.
And I want to take the other premise of Tracy's question, where she says, you know, she's in her mid-40s and she just discovered the way. We've talked almost exclusively about this in the traditional educational concept and really pretty much through the K through 12 or pre-K through 12. Is there application for adults?
Absolutely.
People, Lori, I'll let you have the word on that.
Yes, and this is the greatest news, because as adults, and I feel like I'm learning every day, and I tell my students that I am I'm learning. I am making these neural connections by reading this material, by looking at images, by experiences. So to answer your question, at mid-40s, your brain has such potentiality, such possibility, and it never, ever, ever has to grow old. And we are creating new neural connections every time we embark on something that is interesting or something that we haven't done or something that, we experience. So it's an ongoing process.
I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last word. This has been a fascinating conversation.
It has been.
I really
for
would like
me.
To thank my guests, Lori Desitels, Nikki Woodson, and Terry Small, for joining us.
I am
John.
You're
thank you very much. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.